Barr says the standard failed to strengthen the 24-hour PM 2.5 standard, which would have helped protect Arizonans from short-term spikes in air pollution. Will Humble is the executive director for the Arizona Public Health Association. He contends the new standards are what he calls a call to action for air quality districts around the state and Arizona's Department of Environmental Quality.
Come up with new plans to implement new strategies to reduce the amount of particulate matter that's coming off of agricultural lands, industry, paved roads, even fireplace dust and smoke. So there's a lot of different sources that they're going to have to take a look at now.
Humble says the new standard will prevent air quality districts and the Department of Environmental Quality from placing their monitoring stations in areas that he says they know are clean, instead focusing on communities where people live and work. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Democrats are working to give local governments more control over firearm regulations. Missouri House Democrats have filed H.J.R. 135 in an effort to allow local and city regulators to make their own gun laws. Farah Siddiqui has more on the story.
In 2021, Governor Mike Parson signed the Second Amendment Preservation Act, a controversial law that prevented federal law from overreaching on a person's right to bear arms. Law enforcement agencies with officers who knowingly enforce any federal laws could be sued and fined up to $50,000. Missouri House Minority Leader Crystal Quaid calls the parade shooting an example of the state's weak gun laws.
Law enforcement officers are begging and pleading with us to allow them to do their jobs. The basics of juveniles in the city being able to carry guns and cops pulling them over and not being able to take them from them. And to the speaker's comment, laws don't fix things. And what the hell are we doing as lawmakers? Why are we here at all?
Majority Republicans scrapped a bill which would have allowed concealed guns in transit and places of worship. They did, however, attempt to change Missouri's initiative petition process, which would have made any proposals like this one for local control and even abortion rights difficult to pass. Farah Siddiqui reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 22nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao, Mel Gertov, and Ezra. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Eric Galatis, Alex Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Pakistan's military fails to bury democracy. Dysfunction in Congress on foreign aid. And Israel's war strategy, invading while negotiating. First, Pakistan's military fails to bury democracy. Add Pakistan to the list of countries where democracy is a facade behind which authoritarianism rules. The military has periodically taken power to secure its interests and prevent the reach of democracy into its corrupt practices. Most recently, that meant ousting the popular Prime Minister Imran Khan, a cricket hero who is in jail on charges that amount to 34 years of imprisonment and whose party members are the object of physical attacks. Yet surprises do happen. In parliamentary elections early this month, Khan's party won the most seats, a humiliating defeat for the military, which backs the current prime minister, Nawaz Sharif. Still, the election results could be the start of another political crisis, since Khan's party does not have a majority. Prime Minister Sharif's party is forming a coalition to continue governing, a coalition that will not include Khan's party. Prior to the voting, one Pakistani writer reported on the inescapable gloom that gripped the country, with people wondering, why bother voting? Some, like the writer who pays attention to democracy's slow demise elsewhere, asks, quote, Western countries have been selling Pakistanis on democracy's superiority over all other political systems for as long as we can remember. But in the United States, the Trump presidency and the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, made us scratch our heads and wonder, are Pakistanis trying to become more democratic like the United States, or are Americans inadvertently, carelessly, becoming less democratic like us? Unquote. Good question. But again, surprises do happen when people vote, despite the best efforts to suppress it. Dysfunction in Congress on foreign aid. When it comes to the role of Congress in foreign affairs, nothing these days demonstrates its dysfunction so much as the squabble over aid to Ukraine, Israel, and border security. The $118 billion emergency national security bill passed the Senate with bipartisan approval. It provided $60 billion in additional assistance to Ukraine, $14 billion to Israel, $10 billion in humanitarian aid to Palestinians and Ukrainians, and roughly $6 billion for partners in the Indo-Pacific to counter China. House Republicans have held the Ukraine aid ransom, saying they want more funding for border security, when in fact a bipartisan Senate bill would have given them virtually everything they demanded. But then Trump made it clear that he could not stomach allowing Democrats to get credit for immigration reform. So Republicans withdrew their support of the border security portion of the aid bill, leaving it to the House to approve Ukraine and Israel funding. And there it is likely to die, again at Trump's insistence. Biden denounced Trump's opposition, but to no avail. Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, will not be moved except at Trump's direction. Nine current U.S. ambassadors to Asian countries wrote an unusual letter to congressional leaders urging passage of the aid bill in its original form. Governments, they said, are watching what we do at this pivotal moment in history, a time when decisions that we take now will have lasting impacts for years to come. They want to see that when the chips are down, the United States will be there for our allies and partners, unquote. But in an election year and deep political divisions in Congress and the country, the notion of national interest is out the window. Israel's war strategy, invading while negotiating. Multi-party negotiations on a ceasefire and exchanges of hostages for prisoners continue, with the U.S., Qatar, and Saudi representatives playing the key interlocutor roles. Huge gaps remain between Israel and Hamas. The length of a ceasefire, the sequencing and categories of hostages for prisoners' releases, the end game, more fighting or a war-ending agreement, and the reconstruction of Gaza. A Hamas proposal of February 6 was so far-reaching that its dismissal by Israeli officials was easily predicted. Among other things, the proposal called for a 135-day ceasefire, an end to Israeli military activities, a three-stage exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, and a wide-ranging plan for the reconstruction of Gaza in housing, hospitals, and other facilities. The Hamas plan also envisaged an end to the war to be negotiated before the final release of hostages. While Secretary of State Blinken said he was studying the latest Hamas proposal intensely, Netanyahu rejected it out of hand, calling it delusional. Instead, he's focusing on sending Israeli forces into Rafah, where more than half the population of Gaza has crowded to avoid war. Netanyahu has ordered the army to clear the civilian population out, but to go where? And once cleared out, will Jewish settlers move in as the far right intends? This is a human and possibly military disaster in the making. The U.S. and the U.N. are already highly critical. President Biden said the invasion plan was over the top. An administration spokesman said, quote, given the circumstances and the conditions there that we see right now, we think a military operation at this time would be a disaster for those people, unquote. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called the operation a gigantic tragedy, adding that the war's combatants had violated international laws of conflict over the last 4 months. Half of Gaza's population is now crammed into Rafah, Mr. Guterres said. They have nowhere to go, they have no homes, and they have no hope. They are living in overcrowded makeshift shelters, in unsanitary conditions without running water, electricity, and adequate food supplies, unquote. The situation also is a crisis for Egypt and the fate of the 1978 Israel-Egypt peace treaty. The Egyptian government has warned Israel that the forced relocation of Rafah's population into Egypt would violate that treaty. Egypt fears that such a relocation will become permanent, creating not just a humanitarian crisis, a second Nakba or catastrophe as in 1948, but also a security crisis in that Hamas might become active among the Gazans there, presenting a target for an Israeli incursion. In other news, the Russia-North Korea connection is becoming clearer. U.S. intelligence is finding new details about what Russia-North Korea relations now mean. Russia evidently is acquiring ballistic missiles and ammunition from the North in exchange for North Korea's access to previously frozen bank assets. Those released funds are essential to North Korea as it seeks to finance international transactions, such as oil purchases. Reportedly, the North would like much more than that, such as satellite technology, but the Russians may be limiting their aid to North Korea's access to banking. That would violate UN sanctions, but can be hidden in nearby countries, such as South Ossetia. The closer relations with Russia may help explain Kim Jong-un's recent bluster about nuclear weapons and his recasting of South Korea as an enemy state. He thinks Putin has his back. A U.S. official said the administration is, quote, deeply concerned about the growing relationship between Russia and North Korea and what that might mean for Mr. Kim's intentions, unquote. China may be concerned, too, since for all North Korea's longstanding dependence on China for food and fuel, Kim Jong-un remains a wild card whose actions could precipitate a major war on the Korean Peninsula. At the least, the Kim-Putin partnership will feed additional military spending and tighter defense coordination between U.S. allies, another headache for Beijing. Interestingly, side by side with these developments is ongoing consultation between China and South Korea. Their foreign ministers talked on February 7, pledging further development of their trade and other cooperation. The South Korean minister brought up the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile tests. According to Korean sources, the minister, quote, urged Wang Yi, China's foreign minister, to enhance China's constructive role in encouraging North Korea to halt further provocations and pursue denuclearization, unquote. The Chinese account says that Wang Yi, quote, hoped that all parties will remain calm, exercise restraint, and refrain from words and deeds that aggravate tension. Then Wang said something intriguing, quote, a near neighbor is better than a distant cousin. Was Minister Wang suggesting that South Korea is actually more important to China than North Korea? Aiding Ukraine with Russian money. In previous commentaries, I have noted that European accounts hold billions of dollars in frozen Russian assets, around $327 billion in euros to be exact. And that money could be used to pay for Ukraine's reconstruction. Around 200 billion euros, or $218 billion, sits in the European Union, mostly at Euroclear, a financial clearinghouse for banks and investors. Now, finally, EU leaders have agreed on a crucial $50 billion funding package for Ukraine, apparently clearing the way for financing through these Euroclear accounts. They'd better hurry. Ukraine's strategic situation is worsening by the day. Can technological fixes save us from climate change? There's a long-running debate about fundamental approaches to stopping and reversing climate change. One approach is to go to the heart of its causes, abandon fossil fuels, and conserve energy. The other approach is to use new technologies that might protect against climate threats and provide alternatives to fossil fuels. In the real world, some combination of these approaches seems destined to be the approach on which most of the world relies. The Biden administration has had a mixed record on the first approach, promoting alternative energy, but also giving lip service when it comes to offshore drilling for more oil. One positive recent decision is to deny, at least for now, permits for building new LNG, liquefied natural gas export terminals. The decision has outraged natural gas producers, who argue that it is just the right transition fuel from coal to renewable energy. But that argument ignores the significant leakage of methane in fracking or drilling, as Bill McKibben writes in The Guardian. So the administration's decision on LNG permits is actually a potential win for renewable energy. Two technological innovations have just been reported that could help in the fight against global warming, though not by themselves. Both are in the experimental stage. One is a space shield fixed between Sun and Earth that would reduce warming by a small but meaningful margin, about 2%. The other is a giant hydrogen gas-based battery buried deep in the Earth and available as an alternative form of energy that does not produce carbon dioxide. Regardless of the preferred approach, money talks loudly. Energy conservation and alternative energy sources both depend, though not equally, on consistent and large-scale funding. So here are two more just published stories that offer different sides of the financing issue. On the positive side is Patagonia, which is contributing a certain percentage of its profits to conservation causes. On the other side of the coin is companies that claim to be working on combating global warming, but in fact are doing the opposite. The major oil companies have been exposed for knowing years ago about their causal role in climate change, but hiding the facts, and worse yet, falsely claiming that they are fully behind climate mitigation as they increase drilling and output. Finally, two updates. First, Brazil's police accuse Bolsonaro of a coup conspiracy. Brazil's federal police have accused former President Jair Bolsonaro of having planned a coup following his loss in the 2022 election. The police have amassed evidence of a wide-ranging plot to remain in power, including arresting a Supreme Court justice, recruiting military officers, coordinating protests, and holding new elections. Four people involved in the plot have been arrested following a police raid on a number of Bolsonaro's allies. Recall that in the run-up to the election, Bolsonaro had cast doubt on the election results and asserted that he could only lose because of fraud, a claim that led to a riot in January 2023 in front of Brazil's Congress. Not without reason that Bolsonaro is called the Trump of Latin America. And in Russia, the end of political opposition. In Russia, a government-controlled election commission did as expected. It found a way to keep Vladimir Putin from being challenged in next month's presidential election. Boris Nadezhdin, a former member of parliament, had collected over 100,000 signatures to be a candidate, but the commission ruled that thousands of signatures were invalid. Nadezhdin says he will appeal, but he surely knows Putin prefers running unopposed. And just now comes the terrible news that Putin's longtime chief opponent, Alexei Navalny, has died in prison under, shall we say, suspicious circumstances. His wife, Yulia Navalnaya, has vowed to continue his work. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
This is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon lawmakers are in Salem for their short session. One critical issue they're discussing is Measure 110, Oregon's drug decriminalization measure. Lawmakers have announced their intention to recriminalize drugs through House Bill 4002. But that's only half of what Measure 110 does. It also redirected cannabis tax dollars toward treatment and recovery services, an unprecedented investment for Oregon. Each county created a Behavioral Health Resource Network, or BERN, to disperse these funds. On KBOO News In Depth, we've been speaking with BERN service providers to learn more about their work. Today, we chat with Talia Anderson. She's a full-spectrum doula and proprietor of Yassine's Love, a culturally specific doula service in Portland that also serves parents with substance use disorder. You're a very accomplished person with certifications as a birth and postpartum doula and as a recovery mentor. What does your work look like?
Ooh, my work is busy. Always, it feels like. And then there are peaceful moments. It is rewarding, though. I have to say that. It's very rewarding. The reason why I say that is because to support some families at such a vulnerable time is probably like the best part of it. To be able to be there and hold space in a way that most of the families that I've supported, they have not experienced. considering that my program is culturally and linguistically appropriate for the community that I serve, a lot of times the people that I serve say that they have never felt support like that before, or it was amazing. So I think that that feedback makes the hustle and bustle worth it, you know, the effectiveness of the people that we serve and how we serve them.
What does it look like day to day?
It can look very peaceful and not a whole lot of busyness. And then some days I wake up and I am busy from the moment that I wake up to the moment that I lay down. It depends on what type of day it is, what's going on with my community as far as like the people, the women that I support, and people that identify as women that I support. It can be either way. It can be really slow and steady, and then some days can seem very chaotic.
How did you get started in this type of work?
I started doing this work 8 years ago with a program called Project Nurture. They were a pilot program when I started with them. They had not created the doula peer role. I helped create that role within that program. I was with them for almost five years. And on my fourth year with them, I started to create my own program. I wasn't quite sure where it would go, but I did know that people in my community, meaning the Black and African American or Native American community, were still struggling, even with the support from Project Nurture. They needed something more culturally specific to help with the trauma and the historical trauma, the generational trauma, the type of things that in certain communities we experience. And so because they didn't feel that part of them was supported, but everything else, and it was effective, I started to think about a program that was more specific for my community.
Well, you also serve pregnant people who have a substance use disorder, and that's a more common overlap than people might think. At a research conference on Oregon Measure 110, I heard the statistic that 1 in 10 birthing people have a substance use disorder diagnosis at the time of delivery. So what goes into serving someone who is pregnant and has substance use disorder?
Considering their background, what is the immediate support that they need? Meaning, do they need peer support to help them get resources for housing? Do they need resources for food? Do they need resources for clothing for their other children? Do they have DHS involvement? Do they need resources or advocacy and support in that space? What does that look like in a whole in supporting them even after they birth and give birth to their baby that they are currently pregnant with? Will they have DHS involvement, and what will that look like? So it just depends on the person. And I think that's the reason why I love this type of support, is it's tailor-made for the client. It's not a carbon copy type support. It's not something that I can actually like go to some type of literature and figure it out for every person that I serve. Sometimes it's however they come. That's definitely how I have to meet them, is where they're at, and supporting them from that place on. Sometimes they're actively using, sometimes they're not. They have a history of drug use and they're afraid that the pregnancy may trigger a relapse, or they have a history of mental health and they are afraid that the pregnancy may trigger a mental decomp, and so they come for support.
So your doula service, Yassine's Love, received funding from Measure 110 through the Behavioral Health Resource Network Allocation, or BERN, funding. Can you tell me a little bit about the process of getting those funds and what it's allowed you to do?
The process was something different. I have never thought that I would even get any type of funding to support the work that I did. So, of course, I approached it reluctantly at first. I didn't know what to expect. But it has allowed me to expand my work. I've been able to hire staff to do the same type of work that I do. So, of course, that means serving more people. I've been able to move into a brick and mortar. At first, I was working from home. I had a home office, and I've been able to move into a space where me and my staff can work out of. We can meet clients. Our space is space that is culturally appropriate and supportive and pretty much trauma-informed space. What I mean by that is that when you come into Yasin's Love, it is a space that is built for families. It's kid-friendly. There's toys. There's art in there that is a representation of the community that we serve. And so it's really welcoming to our community. I think that is something that definitely Measure 110 allowed us to do, to give harm reduction resources like Narcan, Plan B, some of the things that people come to us and ask us for. We're able to supply them with, of course, wound care supplies if we have IV drug use within our population that we serve. We have other things that we can give we have a lot of donations from people out in the community, and now that we have space where we can hold it, diapers, breastfeeding supplies for moms that may not have the money to buy those things, and we can pretty much give them to them because they're donated to us. And so Measure 110 has made it possible for us to do a lot of work within the community, especially in the BIPOC community.
How have you seen your work or the work in your field change as a result of Measure 110?
The way that it has impacted families, I would say that's the reason why Measure 110 was brought about, right? To decriminalize mental health and addiction affected people within our community, specifically within the Black community, right? And so a lot of times when we are supporting people in these spaces, like I said, they're involved with DHS or probation and parole. And so to support them through something that can be really scary, and for them to feel supported in that space, to have someone advocate and say what it is they need and what their wants, what would they like to see happen with their family, what they're trying to go after, I would say Measure 110 helped my program impact the community greatly in that way, especially families, because we support pregnant people, but at the end of the day, it impacts families. A lot of times we have partners that ask us for resources, and we're able to give them access to resources. So yeah, I would say it impacted us great in a really positive way.
Are there aspects of your work that you find are misunderstood?
Absolutely. Why is someone pregnant using? That's the one thing that in the beginning of the work I heard, not only from the community, but also from providers. I don't understand why they just can't stop if they're pregnant. And sometimes it's not that easy. Sometimes you need to feel supported. Sometimes you need other resources. You know, sometimes they may want to adopt out baby and not parent and not feel guilty or ashamed about it. And so, I think that's the biggest misconception, is that once someone becomes pregnant, they should be able to do whatever they need to do to be a parent to the child that they're pregnant with, when sometimes that may not be the approach that they are looking for support for. You know, they may look for support for to adopt their baby out. They may look for support to go into treatment and possibly parent, or, you know, but you won't know if you don't ask them and ask what they would like to see happen. And that's the type of support that Yasin's Love provides.
How many clients are you serving at a given time between yourself and your staff?
Oh, goodness. I think this last data, we served 12 in a 3-month period. So that's about the average between 10 to 12 women in a 3-month period. We've had a couple of, I want to say that the biggest thing that we're finding out now is that postpartum support is needed. And I did not ask for help in funding for postpartum support. So I think that we are finding out that clients are sticking around, peers are sticking around a little bit longer for peer support in their postpartum period.
What do you wish people knew about your work as a doula or a substance use recovery mentor?
I wish that they knew that addiction is not a moral deficiency. I wish that they knew that when people struggle with mental health, it wasn't because they are incapable of being having their mental health maintained. I wish that people knew that mental health is not something that anybody should be criminalized for. Support and community is needed more than anything in both of those aspects. And so I wish that more people in the community knew that.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about Yassine's Love or what we've talked about today, where could they find out more?
They can reach out to us. Yassine's Love, you can find us on our website, which is still being built, but there is a contact that you can fill out there and reach out to us, and we will definitely reach out back. You can send an email to our personal email, and that's yassineslove@outlook.com. That is another way that we can be reached. Our website is www.yassineslove.com. Those are two ways. And then, of course, directly to me, 971-990-9326. Those are some of the ways you can reach out to us, and someone will definitely respond.
That was Talia Anderson, full-spectrum doula and proprietor of Yassine's Love, a culturally specific doula service in Portland that also serves patients with substance use disorder. More information about Yassine's Love is online at yassineslove.com. That's YASIINLUV.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Are you eloquent in elephant? Can you converse in chimpanzee? Have a heart-to-heart in horse or chat with a cow?